Dedicated to the survival of American democracy in an increasingly dangerous world, this is Secure Freedom Radio with Frank Gaffney, acted as Assistant Secretary of Defense for International Security Policy under President Ronald Reagan, founder and president of the Center for Security Policy in Washington, D.C., the go-to man for defense and foreign policy issues, joined by the greatest minds in the security policy business, the special forces in the war of ideas at Secure Freedom Radio with Frank Gaffney.
Welcome to Secure Freedom Radio. This is Frank Gaffney, your host and guide for what I think of as an intelligence briefing on the war for the free world. In the course of my time in government and out over some 40 years now, there are a few people who I have come to admire more for the service that they have rendered in lots of ways in this war for the free world than our guest for this full hour. Her name is Deborah Burlingame. She would, I'm sure, describe herself as basically an ordinary American citizen, but one whose life was touched by the horror of jihad on 9/11, 17 years ago today. We're catching up with Deborah after she participated in the memorial service at the Pentagon, where, among others, her brother, Charles Chick Burlingame, the pilot of the American Airlines plane flown into the Pentagon by Saudi Sharia supremacists 17 years ago this morning, was remembered and honored for his service to our country, both in uniform and in connection with that terrible, terrible attack. I am proud to say Deborah is one of my dearest friends, a woman that I have come to love as well as admire over the years we've worked together to try to help Americans understand what happened on that occasion and the challenges that we face from Sharia supremacists abroad and at home in the years since. Deborah Burlingame, welcome back to Secure Freedom Radio, and thank you for giving us a full hour of your time on this very important day.
I'm always happy to talk to you, Frank. And yes, you are one of my good friends and one of the good guys in the fight for freedom. I'm very proud to know you and be associated with your work.
Oh, thank you. The fight for freedom is something I want to talk with you about throughout this hour because you've thought a lot about it and been engaged in various of its battlefronts. But before we get there, Deborah, just give us, if you would, a firsthand sort of impressionistic account, if you will, of the memorial service today, and then we'll talk about the events that it commemorated.
Well, today was, we were expecting heavy rains and bad weather, and we didn't have that, but as a consequence of that, there were fewer people there, and that made it rather intimate and had a different feel. Today was the 10th anniversary of the memorial since it opened there at the Pentagon, and they did special things. They had a uniformed service member at every single one of the memorial benches, representing the people who died, perished in the Pentagon and on the planes on Flight 77. And they had a chorus there from the U.S. Naval Academy, their Glee Club chorus in uniform. And that was very touching for me because Chick was a Naval Academy graduate. There were 14 Naval Academy graduates who were killed that day, most of them in the Naval Command Center at the Pentagon, three on Chick's plane, himself and two others, and another, I think, on Flight 175. So the Naval Academy is very near and dear to the Burlingame family's heart. Lots of fond memories and happy, happy times for our family. So that was very, very special to have them there. Vice President Pence gave the formal remarks, a speech, very touching speech, very detailed. He spent a lot of time talking about the people who died, the responders who saved lives. And he did something I think that will make you very happy, Frank. He twice in his remarks referred to the people who carried out 9/11 as radical Islamic terrorists. That made me very happy because he was standing next to Secretary of Defense Mattis And I think it's very important, as you know, to name the enemy. Can't defeat them if we won't, if can't name them. And here he did this at the perfect place in front of exactly the right people who need to hear it.
Yeah. There's a lot of backstory to that, isn't there, Deborah? We'll, I'm sure, explore it in the course of our conversation with you for this full hour. But I think that the picture that you've just painted is of course, touching. Remind us about the memorial itself. You mentioned the benches, but I don't know, the emotion that is conjured by being in that space, especially with these men and women in uniform who are serving our country today and defending us against these radical Islamic terrorists, among others.
Yes, and I think it's important to mention, and it was mentioned today by a couple of different speakers. I know General Mattis mentioned it, that most of the people who are serving today joined in our, this is an all-volunteer force, because of 9/11, or after 9/11, and specifically because of 9/11. And so it matters very much to them. And including the young man standing at Chick's bench with a Lance Corporal, Marine. He's only been in the service a year. It was wonderful to be able to talk to him about that day and about Chick. It meant a lot to him. Even though, you know, he joined 2017. It still matters to our military. And the memorial itself is, yes, 184 benches. They are situated right on the flight path where the plane went into the building. And they're articulated in a way that the victims are distinguished in terms of the direction the benches are facing. The ones facing the building are the people who perished on the plane, and the ones facing away from the building are the ones who died inside. So it's very pretty with crepe myrtle trees, and they did a good job. It's very moving. It's a hard place, frankly, for me to go to, though, because it's where it's right there on the flight path. It's the very worst day of Chick's life, and of course, by the time that the plane was plummeted into the building, Chick and his co-pilot were already gone. They were killed probably somewhere over the Ohio-Kentucky border after the plane was turned around.
Because they would never have voluntarily relinquished controls of the plane.
We know from the flight data recorder and radar tracking, we actually were shown an animation of the entire flight by the FBI from the moment it pushed back from the gate at Dulles to the moment it impacted the building. And we know exactly where it turned around. We know that a professional pilot was flying it for that turn. In other words, it was either Chick or Dave Charlebois, co-pilot. And as soon as that turn was completed, that's when a life and death battle ensued. In that cockpit that lasted several minutes, Chick fighting for his life.
And anyone who, of course, has seen a cockpit knows what a disadvantage those pilots and co-pilots would be at in such circumstance. Deborah Burlingame, we're going to pause for just a moment. We'll be right back with more about what came next.
Visit us at facebook.com/securefreedom with Frank Gaffney. You're listening to Secure Freedom Radio with Frank Gaffney from the nation's capital in Washington, D.C.
We're back, joined by Deborah Burlingame, a founding member of the National 9/11 Memorial Foundation. And we'll be talking with her about some of her experiences in that regard. She is also a newly established member of the National Medal of Honor Foundation, which is in the process of putting together an important memorial and tribute to the National Honor winners. We'll talk about that, too, in the course of this full hour with Deborah. She is also the sister of U.S. naval veteran and captain of the American Airlines flight flown into the Pentagon on this day 17 years ago. We've just been talking with Deborah about her experiences at the memorial service and some of the experiences her brother had on that fateful day. And Deborah, you and I were discussing for a moment off air why it's so important to you and to all of us, for that matter, to tell that story of what went on in the cockpit on 9/11/2001.
Well, it's history. It happened. I think it's really important that we know as much as we can about what happened that day and how the attacks were carried out. It's personally important for me because I want the public to understand how vicious and brutal these people were, and how hard our people fought them, how hard they fought them to stay alive. And I want the families and friends of the people who perished on his plane, his passengers and crew, and the people inside the Pentagon who died, I want their families and their friends to know that there was a man in that cockpit who died, who did everything he could to keep him from getting control of that plane. And if Chick couldn't do it, no one could have. It's important to me that they know that that there was a fight up there, and it was a fight for them. Chick took his responsibilities as a pilot very, very seriously, both when he was a naval aviator. He was a carrier-based fighter pilot and as an American Airlines pilot for 22 years. Yeah, I remember him saying to one of my brothers, who's a heart surgeon, you know, you have one who had said, you know, when he goes to work, you know, if someone's life is in his hands, Chick said, but when I go to work, there are 200 lives in my hands. He took it very, very seriously. Even though he was a fun guy, he was a very well-liked captain. Bruce liked him. But it's very important that people hear that the viciousness and the inhumanity of what these people did. And the hijackers who were on Chick's flight, if you recall that Dulles Airport, to get to those planes, you have to go on a mobile lounge. So here you had 59 passengers on a mobile lounge with their hijackers. They saw the people they were about to kill, including five children, three 11-year-olds, an 8-year-old, and a 3-year-old. They saw these people. They sat there at the gate, and they sat there in that lounge, and they were close to them, and they knew that these were the people they were about to kill. Very important that be made real to people all these years later.
So, Deborah, this brings us to who these people were and what they were thinking as they were looking at these victims, incipient victims, and what motivated them to do what they did. What have you concluded based upon your study, close study of this question, and obviously informed by 9/11 commissions and countless other sources, but in your own mind, what was going on for them, and what might that tell us about the fate they and people like them have in mind for the rest of us as well?
Well, we know from the debrief of Khalid Sheikh Mohammed in the CIA interrogation program, we know exactly what was on their mind. Khalid Sheikh Mohammed, who had been recruited by the Muslim Brotherhood when he was a teenager.
Could I just interrupt you for 1 second? Because that's so important. You said Khalid Sheikh Mohammed was recruited by the Muslim Brotherhood. And we're often told that the Muslim Brotherhood is a group that has eschewed violence. Do you think that what he ultimately did was informed by what he learned as a Muslim brother?
I think there's no question about it. The Muslim Brotherhood is very much involved in radical Islamic jihad. As you know, they the Muslim Brotherhood and their groups, their legacy groups, were the unindicted co-conspirators in one of the biggest terror support trials in this country in 2007 and 2008, the Holy Land Foundation trial. That is what they do, and this is all informed by Sharia and very explicit passages in the Quran.
So Khalid Sheikh Mohammed, a recruit to the Muslim Brotherhood who graduated into Al-Qaeda, recounted what his Sharia supremacist agenda was in masterminding this attack on 9/11 17 years ago today. So Deborah Burlingame, what did we learn from his deposition, if you will?
We know that he works in the UAE in a normal job. He actually matriculated in a U.S. college in North Carolina. And it is not clear to me what he was actually doing there and what he was studying. But I think that it makes perfect sense that this would be part and parcel of his grooming for engaging with the enemy. But the affidavit that they filed in the Massawi case, Zacharias Massawi was the so-called second wave hijacker that was arrested just before 9/11. And tried and convicted. He's the only person who's convicted as part of a 9/11 conspiracy. But one of the pieces of evidence is entered into his trial was an affidavit that came right out of the interrogation program when after he had finally broken in the EIT program. They basically, the way it was described by people who are familiar with it, said he basically gave a tutorial to his interrogators on exactly what they were doing and how they were doing it, why they were doing it. Very explicit. And this was all part of jihad. You know, he admitted to being the person who actually decapitated Daniel Pearl, the Wall Street Journal reporter. I think the famous words are, "With this blessed hand, I took the life, I decapitated the American reporter, Daniel Pearl." And that has been proven. In fact, he was the guy who did it. They disposed of Daniel Pearl precisely as is outlined in the Quran. Exactly how it outlined in the passages of the Quran. So I think, make no mistake about it, I know that there are people who like to distinguish between Muslims who kill and who are terrorists, and normal Muslims or peaceful Muslims, and that terrorism has nothing to do with Islam. It's simply not true. And I don't think saying that and facing that and accepting it, because you know, history is replete with facts about jihad that has gone on for centuries. I don't think that means that all Muslims are killers. I don't make that connection at all. I don't think it means that you don't like Muslims or you're somehow a bigot against Muslims, because as you know, Frank, most of the people who die at the hands of jihadists are Muslims. They're the biggest victims of jihad, quite frankly, and they know.
Let me ask you about this, because I think this is such an important point, Deborah Burlingame, that let's stipulate that there are a great many Muslims who want no part of the teachings of the Quran or the Hadiths, the accounts of Muhammad's, you know, life and sayings and so on, that are now codified in what's known as Sharia. But the authorities of the faith make no secret of the fact that Sharia is, well, my term for it, you know, sort of the DNA of Islam. It is part and parcel of what the faithful Muslim is supposed to do. So I have found it both accurate and helpful to describe the fault line between the Muslims who are problems on the one hand and the Muslims who are potentially not only not problems but even allies in fighting against this well, to use that term Mike Pence used and the president has used, radical Islamic terrorist threat, is this adherence to Sharia? If they do, chances are they're going to be, if not engaged in the violent kind of jihad against us, certainly performing other types of jihad, whether it's the demographic jihad that we see with refugee flows in Hijra, or the financial jihad that comes with zakat, as it's known, this tax for the faith, or civilization jihad, which will bring us back to the Muslim Brotherhood. And we'll talk about these various forms of jihad and the threat that they pose to us with someone who understands them very well, born of very hard experience. Deborah Burlingame, the sister of the late Chick Burlingame. We'll be right back with more with Deborah right after this.
Now more with Frank Gaffney.
Deborah Burlingame is in the house virtually. I couldn't be more pleased to have her with us, especially on this day of day, 17 years after her beloved brother, Chick Burlingame, was murdered by jihadists. His plane, the American Airlines flight, commandeered and flown into the Pentagon with murderous effect on both the people on the plane, of course, but also many people inside the Pentagon. She is coming to us right after having participated in the memorial service there on the grounds of the Pentagon. And I'm so grateful to you for taking the time once again, Deborah, to talk about all of this. It's good to have you. Let me ask you, Deborah, about this idea that we were just discussing before the break, that in addition to the kind of violent jihad that Khalid Sheikh Mohammed and his cohort perpetrated on our country on 9/11 and many others have since or tried to, both here and abroad as well, of course, we tend, and indeed we've been very strongly encouraged by, among others, the Muslim Brotherhood to focus on this problem very narrowly as one that involves violence. And if Muslims engage in violence, they are a problem, and that's not very many, but the vast majority don't, and therefore they're not. If you draw the fault line between problematic Muslims and ones that quite possibly are not, and may even be very helpful at Sharia instead of violence, it turns out the Muslim Brotherhood is part of the problem. These Sharia supremacists, in other words. And I just would invite you to talk a little bit about, from your studies, I remember when we first met, it was in connection with some work that you were doing as a family member of a 9/11 victim on trying to make sure that we understood who the people are who were in this country, whether they were accurately identified with driver's licenses and the like. It's a larger problem, of course. Are they properly identified, it seems to me, as Sharia supremacists? But talk a little bit about these other non-kinetic forms of jihad as you've come to understand them as a problem as well.
Well, I think that, you know, it's been wrapped up into these, you know, you hear the term from social justice warriors, intersectionality, the whole idea that, you know, we have to have a diverse society. And of course, the diversity is always pitched toward the minority, the newcomer. And that's all fine. But there's a de-emphasis on our own culture, on our own American history, our own values, our own system of laws and the precepts that make America, America. There's been a that is not as valued. We're not teaching that to the newcomers, and we're not even valuing it as worth teaching for newcomers. Yet we're all big on learning the culture of the newcomers. And you know, I think I heard someone recently say that when there's no emphasis on teaching newcomers American history, American values, American system of laws and civics, that they have no reason to seek it out. There's no emphasis on it. So America is going to be balkanized, and what that means for the Islamists and the people who want to bring Sharia to America, and make no mistake, They say it in those terms. I want to bring Sharia to America. They want America to become a Sharia state. They say it out loud. They say it without any self-consciousness whatsoever. The Muslim Brother is a little bit trickier about it because they don't want to alarm anybody. This is stealthy jihad. This is a stealthy form of jihad. But I will tell you, do you remember the Ground Zero Mosque controversy that went on in Lower Manhattan?
Very well. You played an outsized role in that, as I recall, too.
So the Ground Zero Mosque was a project by a couple of Muslim brothers. Their father was an immigrant from Egypt, and that's a whole other story there. But they were building a 15-story, 2,000 mosque that would accommodate 2,000 people, which would have a commanding view of Ground Zero, which was why it was called the Ground Zero Mosque. The imam that was associated with this mosque, Faisal Abdul Rauf, is very much tied to Muslim Brotherhood groups. IIIT is one of them. ISNA is another. He has offices in Malaysia. We researched him, and we found out all the things he said about jihad, Islam, and their plans to bring Sharia worldwide. We had one of our moles sneak into one of his Friday prayers at his little mosque he had at another location. And one of the things he said was, the people who are fighting this mosque will one day, do not realize that one day their children and grandchildren will be Muslims. Now, the people who were fighting, think about this, Frank, the people who were fighting that mosque are mostly 9/11 family members, members of the FDNY first responders, people who were directly affected by 9/11. He was saying that their goal was to reach a tipping point in terms of the Muslim population in Lower Manhattan, that it would become a Muslim neighborhood, and that would be the capital of the Muslim world in the United States.
And Deborah, this is terrifying indeed. One of the points that I think also stood out in that whole exercise, and I remember vividly we were able to celebrate you and, as I recall, 9 other of the Ground Zero stalwarts who fought this some time ago. But it was a teaching moment about why they would do this, kind of like your insights into why the jihadists were, you know, going to do harm to your brother and his passengers. Why were they so intent on having a mosque in close proximity to this hallowed ground?
Because that is the history of what is done in civilization jihad. It is historically true that they build mosques on top of conquered lands, right on top of churches. It's what they do. These are symbolic locations. And Cordoba, the territorial gains they made as they pushed forward in Europe to, until they were stopped at the gates of Vienna, all that is civilization jihad. That is a pillar of Islam, which is to spread the faith. And it's conversion.
Well, and that's what I was going to say. In many cases, particularly in Andalus, as they called it in Spain, where Cordoba is, this was the kinetic kind of jihad in the first place, not so much what the Brotherhood calls civilization jihad. But you're right, absolutely, in the sense that civilization is what they're seeking to conquer and defeat. And interestingly enough, wasn't it the case that they called or proposed to call this Ground Zero Mosque Cordoba House? Kind of a clue.
And in fact, that imam, I saw him on I found a video of him on YouTube in which he was conducting a conversion. Of course, they call it a reversion. They don't call them converts. They call them reverts because they believe everyone is actually born Islam, and then they get sidetracked by their parents or where they happen to live. But he said, this was a CNN story, I don't know if it's still on the internet, but he was gleeful that there had been so many converts to Islam since 9/11. 9/11, he was thrilled that 9/11, which was an attack, remember, that killed nearly 3,000 people, and destroyed Lower Manhattan and a big chunk of the Pentagon, he was gleeful that that had led to an increase in Muslim conversion because 9/11 had piqued people's interest about Islam and they'd had conversions. He was delighted by this.
Well, it's part of the psychological domination, isn't it? That they were victorious, they triumphed, they showed that they were superior in every respect, and that Allah was going to bless their violence with conquest. And Deborah, let me just quickly turn to something you talked about a moment ago, because it's so important, and we'll have to take a break here in just another moment. But the Balkanization of the United States, the idea of having areas of the country that were essentially Muslim only, no-go zones is what they've been called in Europe, of course, and they do exist in Europe. And is there reason to believe that the aspiration of those who seek to bring Sharia here is, in the first instance at least, to create such Muslim-only enclaves and bases from which to try to dominate the rest of the country? Extreme as that sounds to most of us, it's nonetheless the plan.
It is the plan. And, you know, I will distinguish, Frank, between those who really are, they prefer their own neighborhoods. They want to, Dearborn has, I'm told, I haven't been there, but I'm told there are streets you go down, you hear the call to prayer broadcast right out into the public square. It's all in Arabic, the store signs.
Yeah, I've been told it sounds like you're in Lebanon.
Yes, and it's not like you're going to some, like a New York neighborhood where you have Little Italy, Chinatown, and that, which is more like a Disney kind of experience where everybody's welcome. That's not what's going on here. It's exclusionary. They do not want Christian churches. They do not welcome synagogues. They want to convert these neighborhoods. And it's alarming to me. I mean, I lived in New York City before 9/11 for almost 30 years. I know that there were little tiny little storefront mosques all over New York City. Nobody paid much attention to them. These were immigrants who had set them up for a place of worship. That's not what's going on.
Deborah, we have to pause for one last moment. We will be right back with more with the fabulous Deborah Burlingame, a member of the founding board of the National 9/11 Memorial Foundation and sister of the late Chick Burlingame. Right after this.
To securefreedomradio.org today. It's your freedom. It's your country. Frank Gaffney's Secure Freedom Radio. Go to securefreedomradio.org today. It's your freedom. It's your country. Frank Gaffney's Secure Freedom Radio.
We're back. We have with us, as a great blessing and distinct privilege, Deborah Burlingame, the sister of one of those lost on 9/11, who has just come from a memorial service at the Pentagon, where her brother Chick Burlingame, the pilot of the American Airlines airplane that went into the Pentagon, despite his best efforts, was among those commemorated for his service to our country, both in the uniform of the United States Navy and as a pilot for American Airlines. And Deborah, we've been talking about so many interesting things, and I wanted to come back to something that I think can't be emphasized enough, and that is, as you said at the outset, you have to know who the enemy is if you're going to have a chance to defeat them. And one of the reasons that I believe we have become so, well, here we are, 17 years on, so inadequate in defending ourselves and our country and our people against this Sharia supremacist phenomenon is that we have largely been told we can't talk about it. We can't learn about it. We can't train our law enforcement and Homeland Security and intelligence personnel and the military to recognize the nature of the enemy, let alone to develop strategies designed specifically to counter them. Share with us how this bizarre situation has come to pass as you see it.
Well, I think it's grounded in the enemy is very cunning, and one of the things they've done is taken our First Amendment freedom of religion and made that real. They've used that as a weapon against us. So they've infiltrated our government, and it's all pitched on this cultural diversity to stop bigotry. That they coined the term Islamophobia because they saw how well it worked in the gay community, stigmatizing people who were biased against gays. That's the model they use. That's why they use that term. And they basically had a purge at the Pentagon. The briefings that were being given by Steve Coughlin for the Army at the highest levels, he was basically purged out of there at the complaint of their cultural advisor.
Hesham Islam, as I recall, was his name.
Yes, yes, that's exactly right. But, you know, you may not know this, Frank. It's an old story. After the Pan Am 103 crash, do you remember Bill Clinton put together a commission to study airline safety and security? It was headed by Al Gore, the Gore Commission. Guess who was on one of the advisory committees for privacy and passenger screening? When I saw this, I was floored. Nihad Awad, executive director of CARE. He was on the advisory committee, which dealt with privacy and passenger screening. Think about that. That report came out in 1997. That's how long this has been going on.
Yeah, and it's still going on is the point. And Deborah, one of the things that I was reminded of in the midst of the seemingly endless encomiums to the late Senator John McCain, whose passing was marked by, it seemed to be, continuous coverage of memorial services and funerals and so on. And as a man who I knew as a youngster, basically, when I was working at the same time he was in the Navy liaison in the Senate, and I was working for Senator Scoop Jackson, I remember John fondly from those years. But I have to say that one of the real nadirs of his often controversial career in public service was when he attacked a fellow member of Congress, Congresswoman Michelle Bachmann, on the floor of the United States Senate. And I wonder if you might just reconstruct with us what happened on that occasion. And then let's talk a little bit about what came of it.
Well, Michelle Bachmann was one of the leaders in Congress who was raising the alarm about Islamism at every level of government and in our society.
She was seeing it firsthand in Minnesota, where Somalis were on the loose.
Exactly so.
I should say Somali Sharia supremacists were on the loose.
Yes, but I remember some of the Somali people who were begging for help from Congress to stop this. I mean, she was demonized by colleagues, and yes, John McCain was one of them. I can't presume to know what went on in that man's head, but I can tell you this: the 9/11 families who fought very hard for after the 9/11 Commission revealed how our the visa system and travel documents, how the visa system was used by the 9/11 hijackers, how they had 64 driver's licenses and government-issued IDs, how they had gamed, how terrorists, going back to the 1993 bombers, had gamed the asylum system, the immigration system. A couple of the 93 bombers had been admitted to the country to work in the agricultural program in California. But they never set foot in California, but that's how they got in as agricultural workers. We had family members who made this issue their number one issue, who tried to get through to McCain. He verbally attacked them. In fact, I don't like speaking of the dead, but he had to be physically restrained on the street outside the Russell Building by one of his staffers, because a 9/11 family member was asking him why he wasn't supporting real ID, the real ID law, and why he was allowing the wholesale importation of jihadists into our country. He just didn't get it. And I was very aggrieved to see the way Michelle Bachmann was treated. She was heroic. I count her one of the founders of the Tea Party, quite frankly.
Yeah. Oh, she was, for sure. And I think she was one of, and remains really, one of the sort of iconic leaders in trying to call out the truth here about Sharia supremacism. And I commend her for it and hope we'll see more of her in the days ahead. But I will say, I'm convinced, Deborah Burlingame, that due to John McCain's attack on her, there was a lot less interest on the part of a lot of other political figures in taking this question on. And in particular, looking at the degree to which, as she was warning quite correctly, the U.S. government had been penetrated by people who were working for, or at least were sympathetic with, the Muslim Brotherhood or Sharia supremacism more generally. Let me just ask you, Deborah, in closing, you said something earlier that I wanted to just touch base on again. Again, it interestingly enough relates to John McCain. You mentioned that Khalid Sheikh Mohammed was broken. Of course, he was subjected to a sustained campaign, shall we say, of waterboarding to break him. Once he was broken, as you've mentioned, he revealed an enormous amount of information. And as I recall, he told his interrogators, you have to use these techniques because we must resist to the extent we can. Once we can no longer resist, we are free to, you know, provide any information that we need to. But I just would ask, when John McCain inveighed against torture, as someone whose life was, well, subjected to terrible personal loss and upheaval as a result of these merciless Sharia supremacist jihadists, what is your thought on the importance of being able to use, not, you know, pulling out fingernails or putting them on the rack, but things like waterboarding, which we do to our own personnel? I suspect your brother was subjected to it as part of the SEER course, if I'm not mistaken. Certainly other pilots have been. So, I mean, this is a technique that is well established, that is hard to resist if you're being subjected to it, but isn't short of torture, I believe. And that's why we allow our men and women to be subjected to it. But your thoughts, just very quickly, on the importance of being able to get this kind of information, despite what John McCain said again.
Well, first of all, I take issue with the concept that it is torture. They are not tortured. They are put through very unpleasant things, which tens of thousands of our American pilots and special forces operators are put through to teach them how to survive mentally in captivity. The purpose of the program was to create learned helplessness. They were never interrogated when they were going through being subjected to those techniques. The techniques were meant to break them so that then they would be giving out information. And just one little correction there. Khalid Sheikh Mohammed wasn't broken by waterboarding. He figured out what was going on with waterboarding. What broke him was sleep deprivation. And also it was Abu Zubaydah who said, do this for all the brothers, because he felt that it would be better for them and their psyche and their spiritual well-being to know that they had did everything they could before they spilled the beans.
Deborah Burlingame, there is so much more to talk about, and I hope we'll have an opportunity to do so with you again soon. But for the moment, we are at the end of our time for this hour. I cannot tell you how privileged I feel to be able not only to speak with you on this occasion, the 17th anniversary of 9/11, but to share you and your insights with our audience. Bless you. I hope the rest of you will come back as well tomorrow, same time, same station. Until then, this is Frank Gaffney. Thanks for listening.
You've been listening to Secure Freedom Radio with Frank Gaffney.